Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Opti Show with Mackenzie Stewart and Amy Shannon.
We have over 15 years of literary experience between us. Our mission is to educate and assist authors of all writing levels.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. So we are starting Women's History Month. So
yeah.
Very excited about that. Very excited about that.
Oh, yeah, me too. You know, when I was thinking about, you know, what we were going to do for our show today, mm-hmm. you know, we discussed doing Women's History Month. It's something I never really thought of, but I wondered who was I Googled to see who was the first published woman author, because I was pretty interested in that. I mean, and yeah, it was, I think they said it was Julian of North or Norway or something. And it was, her book was published in 1393.
Wow.
So I found that was really interesting. And actually I looked it up to see if it was available on Amazon, because it was called The Divine Romance or something like that. And I actually bought it for my Kindle for 99 cents. So I'm curious. It just made me think of, like, oh, you know, I was looking at all the books on my shelves, and I have a lot of books that are, you know, written by women. I mean, I read books from whoever wants to write one, you know. It doesn't really matter, but I kind of have, like, and I didn't even really mean to. It's just like, I just, you know, I redid my bookshelves again because mm-hmm. I was tired of having books in bins and stuff. And, you know, I moved that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I still had bins full of books. So I got a new bookshelf and I reorganized all my books and everything. And I didn't realize how many of them were or are women authors. And they're also, they're historical women figures too, because I love to read biographies, you know, from my personal reading, and I like biographies in true crime, but I really like reading biographies about the first ladies. I find that they've really, you know, they piqued my interest.
mm-hmm. No, that's great. That's great to know. So I was thinking along the same lines, right? So I was thinking, mm-hmm. What are some interesting women who published? And so I have one yours go way, way back. Mine doesn't go as far back as that. But yeah, you did some digging on that one. Well,
yep.
I have a couple that I want to mm-hmm. kind of talk to you about.
Okay.
And the first is Lena Richard, born 1892 through 1950. And Lena was from the Jim Crow South. She was one of the very first, America's very first celebrity chefs. The first African-American to host her own TV cooking show 14 years before Julia Child made her debut.
Wow.
You know that? I know. Known nationally as the best Creole chef in New Orleans, Richard ran a catering company and international frozen food company international back then. And
yeah.
a series
oh,
of
wow.
restaurants where whites and blacks bucked segregation laws to eat her famous gumbo under one roof. So she did some bridge building through her food. So that is awesome. She also
That's very awesome.
Yeah. Look, she makes me just shameful, right? So, because there's more. Like, there's more. I got to get to stepping on what I need to do to kind of catch up with her. She also opened a cooking school to help members of the local black community command higher wages in the culinary industry. Lena Richards' New Orleans cookbook, which she published in 1939, was the first Creole cookbook written by a black author. Her goal was to make dishes like crawfish, bisque. Her favorite was watermelon ice cream.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, and she also, it was a sherbet.
Wow.
The cookbook became so popular that Houghton Mifflin, they republished it internationally within a year.
Wow.
I know. In 1949, Richard starred in her own half-hour cooking show, which aired twice a week on her local station. And
was it like a PBS station?
I don't know. But
I only wonder because I remember when I started watching cooking shows, the only place that you could really watch them was on PBS, a local PBS station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I don't even remember cooking shows when I was growing up. Like, I don't really. I did remember Julia Child. I did remember her.
When I was a kid, I wasn't, I played. I was a tomboy. And we loved being outside. We weren't sitting in front of the TV all the time. TV time was usually Saturday morning cartoons. And then, after dinner, we could watch a couple shows and then we'd go to bed because we had to go to school. I started watching some cooking shows with my former father-in-law, well, my late father-in-law, and we used to watch them together. So some of the older ones, I know Julia Child, but I don't remember ever watching a cooking show that had the lead was an African-American.
Me either.
This is what a remarkable woman.
Right. Well, for that day and age, for her to be able to sell her food internationally, that was huge, right?
Because I hate saying this, but back then she has two strikes against her. One, she's a woman, and two, she was African American.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about those times and publishing her cookbook in 1939, that was towards the end of the Depression. I bet she really, helped out her neighbors and stuff like that, during the Depression. And, she probably was, it's interesting how she took her food. I watch a lot of cooking shows. I like watching, the Discovery streaming channel, and you get a variety of stuff. And, it's always, I find it's so interesting because then I learn how to put, different flavors together try things that I've never tried before. One thing I never thought I would like because I wasn't really big on cooked greens when I was little, but I can't get enough of collard greens.
Oh,
I like
my
add
goodness.
Them to everything. I do. I mean, that's my go-to green. So, and because they're hearty, and I cook them up, a little salt and peppers, and then a little bacon, and I put them on like a hot sandwich. Well, usually I eat wraps and stuff like that, but that's like my go. That's my go-to green. I don't put lettuce. I cook up collard greens and put them on my sandwich.
Oh, okay. So I'm gonna. So since you said that, I was looking in Better Homes and Gardens. I'm gonna send you this. There's a recipe for collard greens. It kind of reminds you of cream spinach. This collard green recipe, but you cook it in coconut milk, and so I'm gonna send you that recipe. You might like it. We could definitely put it on our site, see if our viewers want to take a look at the recipe. So now let me tell you a game changer for your collard greens. Everybody is gonna be like, we want Amy's collard greens. So I'm gonna tell you. So put a little sugar in it.
Really?
You just want to put a pinch of sugar in it. Yes. Yeah.
I'll have to try that.
Yes. And if you can, I used to use those, I've never used bacon, but I've used, ham pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use like a smoked turkey leg, when you cook it, and you have to cook collard greens a long time, and so you, that smoked turkey leg cooks, and then you have a little of that turkey meat in there, but just a little bit of sugar, you will like, because collard greens are bitter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're bitter, and so by adding a little sugar, that's gonna change the whole flavor of it. So let me know.
I will. Because I was inspired by a local someplace. I am a really huge mushroom fan. And one time my son took me to a local someplace and they had a mushroom sub, and I had never thought about, doing that, because I know mushrooms are very meaty. So I took that idea, and sometimes I'll buy a couple things of, fresh mushrooms. I like the baby bellas and the white, and I cook them down with my own seasonings, and then I put them on a tortilla wrap with some mozzarella cheese and, of course, the cooked collard greens, because once the mushrooms start to break down, I throw the collard greens in there after I've just salted them, and I mix them all together, and then I create a wrap out of it. And it's like, if you like mushrooms, I mean, I really do, and I never thought, I mean, I've seen on TV where, they would, vegetarians will substitute mushrooms for, meat or something, especially like the big portobellos, but I just cut up a whole bunch of little mushrooms, I cook them down, and I probably have enough for two wraps, and I can only eat like one. So, and they're good the next day when you reheat it. It's delicious. And I love collard greens on like my sandwiches and stuff like that, especially hot sandwiches. I'm really big on hot sandwiches. So I started just throwing them right in with the mushrooms, because I add a little butter and Worcestershire sauce and I cook it down. And it's delicious. And that's the cooking hour. Well, cookbooks are, they're books. I actually, a long time ago, when my kids were younger, I created a cookbook. It was just for like my kids, and when each of them turned 18, they got a copy of it. It's just stuff that, like, recipes I made up over the years and things that I've tried and things like that. And, so, like, even though I live with my son Lewis and his fiancé, when he turned, when we moved, he's like, when he turned 18, he's like, okay, where's my cookbook, Mom? You said I was going to have one. So, yeah, you know, family recipes and stuff that I just made up and they loved and growing up. And so I always like to cook, and I don't do it very often. Well, I make my own dinner, but a lot of times it's just something simple. Every once in a while, I'll, you know, make something that's more than one pot.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, so that's the first 15 minutes of the cooking hour, right? So, so I have another amazing person. Did you have anybody that you wanted to share before I get this other amazing person?
No, I mean, I was thinking, and it's going to sound silly, but I really like the older shows, like from the 70s and 80s. So I buy a lot of, like, TV shows on DVD. And I've had Little House on the Prairie for, like, the longest time, and I just started watching it again. And I also have... I have her books that she wrote, you know, and they're more towards children. But then my dad had bought me books about her life, you know, other people wrote, or she wrote for adults. And I remember when I bought the book set, because I used to have one when I was a kid, and then I don't know what happened to it, but then... with my son Robert was in school, and they had the Scholastic book clubs, and I saw that they had the whole set, and it was like $9.95 or something like that. So I bought it, and I've had it ever since. I've read them a few times, but I like the way she tells her stories, and I also. Like, when you see the, like, a lot of the stories on the show, you know, they're made up, things didn't really happen, or, you know, creative, you know, they added their own creativity and writing to the show. But when you read the books and you find out, like, what they go through, it's, to me, it's amazing how the men... they loved their wives. They treated them as if they were frail, but yet most of the wives, they were out doing, like, extremely hard work. They had to, you know, they may have looked, you know, like the weaker sex, so to speak, and I'm using air quotes for weaker sex, but if you ever watched or thought about, you know, even imagine what, like, farmers' wives would do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they were out plowing fields and cooking over hot stoves and, you know, taking care of the animals and things like that. And so I just, I like to honor any farmer's wife. My great grandmother, she was a farmer's wife. My great grandfather, my grandmother who recently passed, her parents, they had a very successful farm. And my grandfather, he worked the farm, and he also worked for General Electric. So he had a full-time job, and, you know, he had a farm to run. My grandmother used to tell us stories about the treks they used to do. You know, it used to take them 2 hours to go 10 miles, you know, with their horse and buggy or whatever. And when she talked about her mother, my grandmother, she was, I remember, I mean, she died in 78, but I remember her very clearly, and she was built like a brick house. She wasn't heavy, but she was a sturdy woman. And I know that sounds really strange, but when my grandmother was telling me about the different things that they would do on the farm, and I could just imagine, you know, seeing my grandmother. And recently, my a cousin of mine, he found footage that GE did with my and my grandma, my great grandmother was in it, in an advertisement for how far GE had come along in the 20s. Yeah, and I think I shared it on my Facebook page a while ago, but I know I have it on my YouTube. I shared it there, but I picture my grandmother or my great grandmother doing those things, and I can't imagine. And she had, oh, let's see, she had six children, I want to say. I don't remember, but I think it was like six children, all at her feet, and she took care of the house. She took care of the animals. She plowed fields. She had to walk the cows down about a half mile to the creek for water. So I kind of want to, for all farmers' wives, past, present, future, thank you for the hard work that you do. And not everybody appreciates it. Not a lot of people think about where their food comes from. But, I mean, when they were running the farm, my grandmother told me that they had gardens for them, and then they had gardens that they would use so they could either help feed their neighbors, because it was the Depression. So they would give away food to their neighbors. If they didn't have food, they'd give away coal if they didn't have heat. My grandmother said that she knew there was a Depression going on because she could see it in the newspaper, but at home they never felt it because they always had food. You know, their parents were very hardworking. She said the only chore that her mother would do and didn't want anybody else doing it was candling the eggs. And she goes, and I never knew why. I'm like, grandmother, I said, it's the same reason why mothers like doing the dishes, so nobody will come in and bother them. That was her chore. That was like her, you know, she liked doing it. She could go in the basement, close the door, be away from the kids and the husband, and she could just relax and candle the eggs. And back then, yes, they actually used a candle and held the egg up to it. So it's not like, I mean, they do some kind of, I don't know what they do now. I know it's a similar process, but it's not with an actual candle. But yeah, so I just kind of want to do a shout out to all the farmers' wives and thank you for your hard work that is never ending.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So I'm going to help the listeners out on trivia night. So I'm going to help. So did you know? So Laura Dolly Johnson, born in 1852 through 1918. And did you know that she was the White House cook for two presidents? That will get you some trivia right there, right? That will get you some trivia, right? So, yes.
What was her name again? I want to make note of this. What was her name again?
Yeah, her name is Laura, but they call her Dolly Johnson. Mm-hmm. She was the White House head cook. So, they said that, you know, and I guess it's kind of, you know, your thought about, you know, acknowledging farmers' wives and the hard work that they do. But, you know, the White House head cook is one of the most respected and hard jobs, too. And so she was, you know, respected by the president's family. And so she did everything from preparing the president's meals, She was a former slave from Kentucky. She held the position twice. In 1889, President Benjamin Harrison hired Johnson after firing his French chef. He wanted more hearty food. He didn't want that French food. He wanted hearty bluegrass cooking. That's what they call bluegrass cooking. And yes. And so it was amazing for her to have that type of job in the first place. And but it definitely took her a while to, you know, take the actual job. So her very first meal when she first arrived at the White House, she cooked, so here's some other trivia, right? It was Blue Point oysters, turkey, cranberry jelly, mince pie, plum pudding. So she had to leave 7 months after she started this particular job to help take care of her daughter, but she came back. So President Grover Cleveland, during his second term, he wanted her back. So she came back. She worked for a year. Grover fired her. And then he wanted her back, but she refused to come back. And so she took a stand and did not go back. And when she did go back home, back to Kentucky, he was the first Black woman to own a business on Lexington Main Street. She opened a catering and a number of restaurants, including one that was named the White House Cafe. And, you know, she definitely did her thing, right? She was a trailblazer during her time and, you know, really inspired others in the field of culinary as a career. So that is Laura Dolly Johnson. So our hat goes off to her.
Oh, definitely. You know, I always found what was interesting is that, you know, there used to be the mindset that a woman's place was in the kitchen, but only in the kitchen of her home, not like a chef, you know. Mm. And even now, like I, men and women chefs that I like and stuff like that, but that even now, they say that it's still, you know, they may have these up-and-coming women chefs, and but it's still majority male, which I always found was so interesting. It's like, oh, they're good enough to cook your dinner when you get home, but they're not good enough for you to go to a restaurant and pay for it. So definitely, yeah, when you have the resume and it says, oh, I was a White House chef, there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have another one.
Okay.
I have another trailblazer, but I want to see if you had one that you wanted to share before I dive right in.
You know, I was thinking about Maya Angelou, and I have a you know, her poetry, and it's you know, sometimes it's like they're so inspiring. These women are very inspiring, whether they're white or African American. You know, they pushed through doing what they were doing. And it's like, you know, there's something there because, you know, we got a month, Women's History Month. So maybe, you know, in 30 years, somebody will be saying, hey, does anybody remember Mackenzie Stewart and Amy Shannon? You know, but, you know, it's I find it interesting. I mean, we put our name on a, well, books, and, you know, even if that is, like, a legacy, I think that not just you and I are inspired by all of these women that we've discussed and many that, you know, we may not have even time to. I'm inspired by you. Sometimes you keep me going. And when just, you know, it's not always easy to get out of bed in the morning, but I do. You know, I get out of bed and I keep going, and your friendship and this show and your work, which I like to read a lot. Like, you know, when I sent you that document, I was like reading it. I wasn't just like looking to fix it. I'm like, oh, that's right, I remember that part. But, you know, I hope that one day, you know, maybe I will be someone else's inspiration. You know, that's just kind of that. But anyone who, true to themselves and keeps pushing forward, no matter what, even when you get knocked down, and every time I've gotten knocked down, I always get back up again. But, you know, I think that we should celebrate those people that inspire us and let them know if they do. I mean, some of these people we can't, you know, they're gone, but their legacy was on. And I hope that they know that, you know, even though we didn't know them personally, they, whatever they did, paved the way for even just you and me being able to be like on the air like this. You know what I mean? It's so, you know, thank you for every woman that came before us and fought hard and taught us how to push forward and keep going. And, you know, I think our mothers had a lot to do with that as well. So thank you, moms.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. So I have another that I want to shout out. Melinda Russell. So there seems to be a common theme here. They've published cookbooks, right? Yeah, this is a food hour. Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah, so Melinda Russell, 1812, and history doesn't really show the end date, but she's a self-published, she self-published a domestic cookbook containing a careful selection of useful recipes for the kitchen in 1866. And so she was looking to make, you know, lots of money, you know, from this particular, you know, book to take care of, you know, herself and her family.
Right.
But she was selling the book. She got robbed. And so she fled Tennessee to go to Michigan. And one of the things that that she did, that she was recognized in 2000. So in 2000, Russell was cookbook was recognized as the first to be the authored by an African-American after a culinary historian discovered the only surviving copy. So she was celebrated in 2000. You know, her cookbook, and we have to remember, like, you know, during that particular time, there was a lot of home remedies, and her cookbook had a lot of those home remedies in it. So that's why it was really popular, you know, among people, because, you know, there was not all this, you know, medication that we have, you know, today. There's, you know, you take this and this. Yeah, just like I gave you some excellent tips. I gave you tips on how to get that tickle out of your throat. And you didn't take me up on it, and I'm pretty glad you didn't. But
I still use, and it's something that my grandmother used, baking soda and water. And yes, it tastes disgusting, but it helps get rid of, like, you know, if you have, you know, upset stomach, or, you know, you have like acid reflux or something. I still use that. I don't have to buy like antacid or anything like that. I just use that. Bicarbonate soda, that's what in most acids anyways. Tastes nasty, but it works.
So she had lots of home remedies, and the one thing that really made her cookbook really popular, she kept it short and simple. Everything, the recipes were short and simple, and because she knew that they had people that was reading the book, they only had basic culinary skills. So she didn't need to make it overly complicated or anything like that. Now, in her cookbook, she had more pastries than, you know, some of the other women we were discussing. So she had most of the pastries. So she definitely was able to bring food, you know, to life, and also with the home remedies, and she definitely helped us with understanding our how to bake pastries, and then also how to, you know, start a restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's wonderful that, you know, this historian discovered this, you know, in 2000, but in a way it's also sad that this information wasn't known for so long.
Absolutely. So Amy, did you have, you know, someone else you wanted to celebrate tonight?
I recently, well, several months ago, I read Anne Frank's diary, and I had never read it before. And you know, when she wrote in her diary, she wasn't thinking someone else is going to read this.
Mm-hmm.
And her father was the only survivor of the Frank family, and he insisted. He knew that people needed to know what they went through, and from, you know, because his daughter chronicled her life and her feelings and her perception, and she was closer to her father than she was her mother. But in the end, only he survived, and he fought to get her diary published so people would know the truth. And I know a lot of people, you know, when they think of that time in history, you know, sometimes that, you know, Anne Frank's name comes up. But she was a child whose words, you know, it made them realize the truth, and it also angered the Germans, and it is, it was one of the most burned book in the night. Soon after it was published, I think it was sometime in the 1940s, when it went to press, it was and it was mainly burned in Germany towns.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to. She didn't live a full life. She lived a hard life.
Mm-hmm.
But her words made an impact. So.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. So I have another person I would like to give a shout out to. And I'm still on my theme of food.
That's
so,
okay.
Yeah, I'm still on my theme of food. I want to celebrate Georgia Gilmore, 1920 through 1990. And Georgia Gilmore was a cook, a midwife, and a mother of six, living in Montgomery, Alabama. And she was known for making the best pork chops in town. So she was the person that you go to. Yeah, the best pork chops in town. And this particular asset, the pork chops, this particular asset made her well known during the bus boycott in Alabama. Bus boycott, in 1955. So as the boycott took place, it took off. Gilmore started selling fried chicken sandwiches to protesters and at organizing meetings. They were donating their profits to her movement. Soon she was able to create a community of women who were cooking and also selling dinners, cakes all over, and pies all over town. They turned their food as a tool to resistance during the 381-day boycott because many of them feared losing their job if their employers found out. Gilmore kept their identities a secret, and she named the clandestine, you know, way of, you know, the money coming in, clubs nowhere, right? So people want to know where are you getting this money to do it? Oh, it came from nowhere.
Hey,
so
that works.
Yeah, that was her response. So they call it the club from nowhere. I thought that was really cute. So also she actually ended up losing her job after testifying on behalf of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and 89 other protesters who'd been arrested. Afterward, he encouraged her to open a restaurant inside her home, and he helped her pay for the equipment.
Wow.
It soon became a gathering place for civil rights activists and all races to strategize and feast on Gilmore's stuffed pork chops. And that was one of MLK's favorite dishes that she cooked.
Wow.
She cooked fried chicken, fish, your favorite collard greens, and pound cake. In a full circle movement, Gilmore's civil rights journey ended in the kitchen where it began. She died in 1990 while cooking for the 25th anniversary of the 1965 March to Selma to Montgomery. The chicken and macaroni and cheese she made were later saved for her mourners. And I think that she probably would have approved on that. So, yeah. So she died while she was cooking in her kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, she died the way she lived. So, I mean, that's all that anyone really wants. So, well, my hat. Oh, man. It makes me want to say, okay, where's those stuffed pork chops? What's that recipe?
Oh, I know, right?
I haven't had a good pork chop in a very long time because I I don't do as much cooking as I used to, but I mean, that just sounds delicious. And I know stuffed pork chops, because they're thick and they're hard to cook, and pork chops themselves are not that, you know, there's a very fine line between moist and dry. When it comes to pork chops.
Yep. Right. You're right about that. It is a very thin line. You're right about that. Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm thinking that the stuffing part makes it a little bit more moist, right? So if you do cook it a little too much, then the stuffing will help keep it moist. So.
Yeah. I always like mine with applesauce too. it's just those things. But I also found sometimes that I like, one time I tried it, I didn't have applesauce, I only had an apple and an onion, so I roasted the apple and onion together and then put those on top of my pork chops, and it was delicious. But yeah, when I eat pork chops, I buy applesauce. It's the only time I eat applesauce is if I have pork.
Yeah, because I've had the spice, that you put the allspice on the apples to cook apples. So yeah, I've had it that way. Yeah. Mhm. Yeah. So maybe we should just do a share out on recipes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, people cook like. From what I understand, you know, a lot of work goes into putting a cookbook together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even these celebrity chefs or just chefs that have, you know, cookbooks and stuff like that, you know, they have to try the recipes. They, you know, they do the photos of them. And,
right.
They got to look appealing without all that, you know, like fake stuff that makes food shiny and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of work that goes into these. And I'm sure that even with these cooks, these chefs that we discussed, and they created their cookbooks, they had to probably handwrite them. And so I can, you know, I know that it's just a lot of work. I mean, because even when I was putting mine together, mine was just for family. It's like, sometimes it's a pinch of this and it's a dash of that. And then you're like, well, how do you put that? You know, there's just a little bit of this, a dab of this, you know, a dollop or whatever. And it's like, you have to like try to quantify it and, you know, decide, oh, well, is that a tablespoon or a teaspoon? Or I don't know. I usually do just three shakes of salt or, but yeah, I mean, it's a lot of work. And then especially you put it together and then you've got to get it published. No matter how you get it published, it's still, you know, you want it to look professional. So it would be, I would love to get my hands onto some of these cookbooks and, you know, read the recipes and maybe try some. I like to try new things. And it's funny because there's some things that, like, my mom was a really good cook, but she always cooked things a certain way. I mean, she knew, like, 1,000 different ways to make chicken and 1,000 different ways to use ground beef, because back then, in the 70s and 80s, it was cheaper to buy ground beef and chicken than it was anything else. I never had a steak until I was an adult. A couple times, my mom would get venison from her friend whose husband was a hunter, and but she would never tell anybody that it was venison. She would just say it was steak. But she knew how to cook it, so you didn't get that gamey taste. Only I knew what it was. I enjoyed it. But I my mom also had this. That's how she sometimes she would just be inspired by someone's recipe, and then she would kind of make it her own. And I didn't know what happened to it. And then one time I found it on Amazon. It was, you know, it was copyrighted 1972, but I have a copy of it. And it's really interesting to see, because my mom used to make this applesauce cake, and it was so delicious. And it took me years of trial and error, because she didn't write the recipe down, to be able to make that particular recipe and different seasonings and stuff like that. And then finally, once I think, oh, yeah, I've got it, except it's missing my mom's love, but I know it's in there. Then I discover this cookbook. I found it, and then I found the recipe that was in there that inspired my mom's recipe, and it was very, very similar to what I came up with. But, you know, it was like trial and error, like, oh, I don't know, this doesn't taste too much, but, you know, now I have it, so.
So I have a tip for you.
Okay.
So if you want to, so you know how, so even if you do a box cake, if you, you can substitute the oil for applesauce. And your cake will come out moist. It will come out moist.
Yeah, I've heard that. I substituted eggs with mayonnaise before. And one thing that I used to do, even with especially with box cake, is instead of just whisking the eggs in there, I used to whip the egg whites separately. And then your cake becomes much more light and fluffy when you, like, you know, fold in those egg whites. So, I've also made a lot of baking mistakes. And one time I didn't realize it wasn't, I made this chocolate cake for my kids. And I tried to frost it and it wasn't cool enough, so it ended up looking like gravel. So I made it into with frosting. I made it in the shape of a volcano, and I said, "Here's your volcano cake." it would be just like you would make a cake pop now. I mixed it in with the frosting, and then I always, even if I use regular like store bought frosting, I always mix it with cream cheese before I frost the cake. Because that will get rid of that extra, it's too sweet kind of stuff. And sometimes I just melt it down and, you know, melt down the frosting and just pour it over the cake or dip the cupcakes right into it. Makes it a lot easier.
Now, those are some good tips. Wow. I mean, you know, we should just have a cooking show because, you know, this whole thing turned into, how to cook. So
when you think about it, you know, food is one of those things that brings people together, whether I mean, when I was a kid, we all sat down at the table at the same time and had family dinners. That's just how it was. And I tried to do that with my kids. You know, even if we didn't have a kitchen table and we ate in the living room together, now me and my son William, we have our own tradition, but I always tell Lewis and Freesha, I'm like, let me know when you guys have a night off together, and then like, they love my baked macaroni and cheese, so I'll make that for them. Then we all sit down at the table together. Sometimes we just order Chinese or whatever. At least once a month, we try to the four of us sit down together. But it's every night. It's me and William. We sit down. We eat together. We sometimes we watch some shows or we watch a movie, and that's our evening. And, you know, he said that it was his idea, and it's a way to it's something that he'll never forget, you know, even, you know, in 50 years when I'm dead, he'll still remember, you know, our meals together. And, you know, we don't take each other for granted. We learned that a long time ago. I mean, whenever one of us leaves the house, we always hug and we say, I love you. And when they come home, I always ask them how their day was. Melissa rolls his eyes and says, fine, Mom. But, you know, it's, but yeah, like, I know I just kind of went off on track, but it was always, it's always like food that it brings people together, whether you're cooking together or you're eating together or maybe both. Or if you think about family reunions or, you know, outside gatherings, it's, you've got grills and people, you know, bringing different types of salads and all of that kind of thing, bringing people together. And this has been happening probably since the dawn of time. You know, I mean, think of it. The first, the most famous food was the forbidden fruit, and it was still food. But, you know, we all make bad decisions, and probably because of that, but food brings people together. And and cookbooks are they're a literary tool, because sometimes, and I, when I was writing my cookbook, I would write, if a recipe was special to me for whatever reason, I kind of wrote that little story. Like, when I was a kid, my mom and I, on Saturdays, we would do baking together. You know, we would bake some snacks or whatever. You know, we didn't, my mom didn't store buy, you know, baked goods or cake or, you know, Twinkies or whatever, you know, nothing like that. If we had a snack that was a baked good, it was something that she made, so she could control what she put in it, you know. And she also taught me how to substitute. You know, one time we made a cake and we ran out of flour, so she just used pancake batter mix, and the cake came out just delicious. It's got everything in it.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that. Wow. That is so true. That is definitely so true. Well, Amy, it's definitely been a pleasure celebrating Women's History Month with you. And so the listeners, you can find out everything that you need to know about the after show. Thank you for listening to the after show. I'm Mackenzie Stewart.
And I'm Amy Shannon. And like Mackenzie said, everything is on our website. And maybe we'll share some recipes on our blog, The Right View. So join us again next week.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.